Okay, so we are sitting here today with Janet Waldner. She was the librarian here for how long, Janet?
28 years.
28 years. So what year did you first arrive?
I started in 1968.
Wow, and when was your... And Annette took over for you, right?
Yes.
So that was like 90-something?
Let's see, I'm 90 now. So it was 20 years ago, because I was 70 when I retired. Mm-hmm. So that would have been...
This is 1996.
Yeah,
1996.
Yep.
Right.
Wow.
And so lots of changes.
Yeah. So I guess we'll just start diving right into it. So I heard that the library started out as a city library.
We were a city library. And the library had been closed for quite a while.
Oh, so you were part of when it started, when it reopened.
And I was one of the women that we used to go down to Lansing and bug them to let us be open again. And they finally did. But the only books we could have were old books that the library in Traverse City didn't want anymore.
Wow.
So we'd go down and pile up our cars with books and bring them back here and hope that people would donate books and things. We were only open 15 hours a week.
Wow.
When we started back then.
So did you just like walk into like an empty building then? Because the building was here.
The building was here. The building was empty except for books they really, really didn't want.
Do you know what made them shut it down? Was it just cost? It was just costly to operate?
It was when they built the new high school, the new school, and they tore the old school down because the library used to be the school library. Well, when they built the new school and they put a library in that school, so therefore, in their minds, they didn't need the library anymore, and the city fathers wasn't interested in whether the people of the city itself needed a library or not.
All they cared about were the kids going to school.
Right.
Wow.
Well, that's basically the rebirth of the library, because the original library years ago was started by a group of ladies in Boyan, who then were, I believe it was a doctor or a lawyer, donated his library to these ladies, and they started the library from scratch.
Wow.
And then the Carnegie Grant came in, put the building in.
Right.
And then it dropped off because the school started up a library. And it's when Janet
it was the Ladies Study Club.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it funny how now the school is dropping their libraries and they're coming to us? Like, that seems kind of crazy.
The school dropped the library position for a librarian.
Yeah.
The school has?
Yeah.
Yes,
so
school.
We hired her.
Yeah. Oh, for heaven's sake.
I know.
The high school has no librarian.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Because I mean, we always used to get a lot of, especially when we started being open more.
Mm-hmm.
We were always closed on Friday night because Friday night was game night. And so you were closed on game night. But I finally got us open to like 40 hours a week and open on Sundays a little bit.
Wow.
So that people could. But Nancy Fulkerson, who was my assistant, I hired her right out of high school. And she was with me she was still here till... When did she die? Last year?
Yep. Yeah.
And Nancy was a gem.
She was here 35 years, yep.
You could say to her, I read a book once, and it took place in Serbia, and I can't remember the name of it. And she'd tell you the name of it.
Yep.
She had that kind of a memory. It was fantastic, absolutely fantastic.
Yep.
And our main... I found out that my main job was to make the city aware that we needed a library and make the townships aware that we needed library.
So you were doing a lot of advocacy then for the library.
Because I'd go to city meetings, and the first time I went, department head meetings, because the librarian never used to go. Nobody would go from the library, and then they told me that I was their token woman. So you can tell it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And they told me that the, as far as they knew, they didn't ever know, none of them knew anybody that went to the library. And
were you like, yeah, and that's kind of sad.
I said, that's very sad.
Yeah.
Or else they're very, very wealthy.
Yeah.
And can buy all their books.
Right, right. So what made you love the library so much?
Well, I've always loved books. Mm-hmm. I mean, that used to be my present when I was 10 or 12 years old, with Nancy Drew and mysteries, and I'm still a mystery fanatic. And my girlfriend and I would spend hours, days if possible, reading. I've always been curious. Mm-hmm. I think curiosity is a great part of it. I want to know things. If I see something happening in the sky, I want to know what's happening with it and why it's happening. Or I want to know what the weather is doing and why it's doing it. I'm curious. Mm-hmm. And if you're curious, then you find you need to read in order to find out things, to satisfy that curiosity. And so that's how I think that I became a reader. And I had a degree in English, and journalism really was my topic in college. But I went to work in a newspaper, and I didn't like the people back then. Were mostly up through the ranks. And there were, I mean, you're talking a tough bunch. You're talking mafia types.
Yeah.
And I was a young girl, and I just couldn't deal with those kind of people. So I was a housewife, and one of the board members knew that I was looking for a job, and they asked me if I'd like to be the librarian. And then I went away to classes and things like that to be certified by the state.
Got it.
And I made 75 cents an hour.
Wow, that's amazing. That is amazing. 75 cents an hour.
75 cents an hour. Kids nowadays would, I can't get anybody to mow my lawn for that.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and right.
But that's how it came about. And then you're a liaison between the city and the city council.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's your job basically, is to get under their skin enough so that they give you money. When I started out, we had no budget. I would have, if I wanted a pen or a pencil, I had to go down to City Hall and say, will you give me $1 for a pencil? And so, but I found out, I had taken accounting in college just as, because it was I thought it was a good thing to do. And a business course, and any business courses you take come in so handy. I don't care if it is a library job.
Yep.
You need that, because a lot of your work is business. I mean, you have to do a budget.
Yep.
You have to do payroll. You have to hire. You have to fire.
Mm-hmm.
You have to keep people on the straight and narrow. And
so what kind of, so like, obviously the library is a lot different today than it was back in the day. So what were your main services? So obviously there were books, but did you do other things here at the library?
Yes, we had a RIF program, which is,
yes, I loved RIF.
Right.
As a kid. Gosh,
and I
awesome.
Found something out. I applied for a RIF grant and I received it, and I put the money in the bank. And I was so proud of myself because all our expenses came from the interest, my bank account. And the state said I had to give that money back to them because you're not supposed to make any money off, you're not even to pay your expenses. That had to come out of the grant. Mm. So, which upset me quite a bit because I didn't see the logic of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't logical if you get right down to it.
Yeah.
And but it was an extremely rewarding job.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt that the thing you had to do was find out when I came to the library as a patron before it got closed down, because I was here when they tore down the old school. In fact, I have some of the slate that was in the old school.
Oh, that's cool.
And the only books that were, any books that had the slightest hint of romance or anything like that were hidden from view. You had to ask for them.
This was in the old library? This was with Mrs. Cook. So did you take over for Mrs. Cook?
No. Let's see. It was Mrs. Cook was the first librarian, and then I think Nancy, I can't remember her last name right now, was sort of an interim librarian.
Mm-hmm.
And But the library books that they had weren't worth, I mean, they were books that nobody really wanted, mm-hmm, or wanted to read. And my premise was, you don't have books that you particularly like, although I did have a lot of books that I liked, but you find out what your patrons want.
Right.
And that's who you cater to. And I found out that I liked history and mysteries,
mm-hmm,
mostly. And I found out a lot of my patrons liked that too. So it was a very, very rewarding experience. I had one little boy that used to come in from when the middle school was across the street, and he didn't really enjoy. He used to come in to talk to me more than anything else. I think the kid was lonely. And he'd tell me about his uncle who was in the service. And he looked up to him and everything. And he came over one time and he said, I have to read a book by Shakespeare. And he said, I don't know what I'm going to do. And so I said to him, I'll tell you what, why don't you read one of Shakespeare's books about Macduff, who was Macbeth was the book, and I said, because they're the first ones to use camouflage, like your uncle does in the service. And because I said, they make a whole forest move. And so he thought about that, and he thought, they're the first ones to use camouflage? And I said, yep, you read the book and you'll find out they were the first ones to use camouflage. And so he read the book, and I that always stuck with me, and I was very, I don't know, I was very pleased with him.
Yeah.
And very gratified to think that I had thought of something way to make him look at a book from a different angle.
Well, you mentioned a few minutes ago your curiosity taking you to books. And what you're describing now is your ability to raise a child's curiosity and bring him to books.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Well, your ability, I've known you since I came here in 62.
Oh, yeah.
And your ability to converse with me on any subject, no matter how wild, from left, right, blue, green, black, or white, you've had an ability to have an intelligent conversation on any subject I've brought forth.
Well, thank you.
And I'm sure that's because of your love for reading.
That's right. And that's because of, I feel very sorry. I feel when people don't have a curiosity anymore, they're dead. Your brain dead.
Yeah.
It should be a test for maybe senility or something, because there's always something new to learn. At home, I get the Smithsonian Magazine and National Geographic, and because besides a whole bunch of other magazines that I get too many of, and there's always something in there that I don't know about or that I'm curious about.
And when you've seen the library through several phases of libraries.
Yes.
What triggered you to realize that we had to move from books to some recordings, some video, and head in the direction where we now are providing full internet services to the community?
Well, I realized that people were renting movies a lot, my own family included, and particularly teenagers. And so I felt we should have some access, that they should have some access that wasn't costing an arm and a leg. Mm-hmm. And maybe we could get, because the library has more of the, what I call PBS type movies and things, and there, a lot of them are wonderful, and you can't, I don't believe, now I'm not positive, because I don't rent movies, but I believe that, I don't know that you can rent a lot of what we have. The library has become another source of visuals, because a lot of people are very visually oriented. They have to have something to see besides the written word. And now,
yeah. So you've seen the collection change. It went from books to movies to, you know, audiobooks, those types
right.
of things.
Yeah. And then, because we've always had the large print, or, well, not to a great extent, but now we have the large print. And, yeah, you see the more that the kids become interested in social media, the more they are interested in our collection.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And
so,
and you have any library or any institution for that matter that caters to the public is duty bound, I feel, to have a variety of ways that are accessible for the same thing. I mean, you might see a movie and that will bring you to, oh, I want to read that book, or I saw a good movie and I want to read that series. That will not only bring people in the library, it'll bring them into bookstores and other places like that.
Yep.
I think sometimes bookstores may be a little bit short-sighted in that they could give, maybe when they get their bestsellers in, they could give them a copy to each of the libraries in their community if they're in a large city where they have several libraries or so.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's a selling tool, it's a marketing tool.
Mm-hmm.
The library helps the merchants around town, because we have cookbooks which make people go to the grain train or the stores and want to try out a new recipe.
Mm-hmm.
And it teaches diversity. And I don't always see things like this happening. I think sometimes it's a missed opportunity for merchandising.
That's a. I'm glad you brought up diversity. So I belong to this MLA group, and we're working on a conference. But there's all these librarians from downstate in the big city, and we just had a meeting last week, and they kind of called me on the carpet, and they were saying, just asking what we're doing in our area, our library in particular, to promote diversity. So it got me, you know, and I told them, you know, we try with our collection, we try to, you know, do other, you know, programs that enhance the, you know, the cultural awareness of our community. But it really got me feeling kind of like wondering what our role as a library is to provide that kind of opportunity for our community. What do you think? I mean, about, do you think it's the library's duty to provide their patron base with?
Well, I think it's, yeah, I like to see as much of it as is feasible, mm-hmm. I'll put it that way, because you have to look at your library budget, which is usually pretty stringent,
mm-hmm.
and do what you can within that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it behooves the merchandisers in your town, your stores and things like that, to maybe cooperate a little bit. Like if you have they could come to the library, for instance, and say, what books do you have books on wine? And what kinds of wine, where are they grown, and things like that, everything that pertains to the wine. And then if they were advertising 1 week a particular red wine, or that was from either Italy or wherever it came from, that could tie in with something from the library, saying if you go to the library, there would be a book on the wines of certain regions,
mm-hmm.
of the world. And I don't know that much about wine.
Yeah,
but,
me either, but yeah. Right.
But you get my drift.
Yep.
And then I think that they could offer to give the library a couple of books if we didn't have enough of them, because in that way, what goes around comes around. They're going to, if they give that, if people come in and read about them, they're going to go down and say, I read about this wine and I want to try it. And they're going to buy it.
Yep.
I'm a firm believer in that. I'm a firm believer in merchandising and everything else. I don't think the two are, I don't think they should be fighting with each other. I don't think they're separate. I think they're all a part of a one business type working deal, they can be.
The businesses would do well to support each other, and that's community support for the community activities.
Right.
It's, and I've noticed just sometimes here, the weather's bad, the merchants suffer,
right.
And I come to the library and I have trouble finding a chair. It's so it depends a lot on the psychology of the community, of our country, of the weather, of what we're doing, the time of the year.
Right.
And we need to be flexible with that.
Right.
But it's when you were heading up the library, if you needed additional funding for something, what methods did you use to assist in raising funding?
Actually, if we felt we needed something or we wanted cooperation,
mm-hmm.
it was a one-on-one, right in your face. I'd go from door to door. I remember one time I went in the old tannery when, what was his name? Terry Toomey?
Yes.
Yes, had it. And he got very, he didn't like me being in there.
Mm-hmm.
he felt it was sort of too blue stocking or something, that I shouldn't be in there. And it made, I knew some of the younger men that were in there because through my own kids, and it made them all feel so ashamed that they came into the library.
Hey, whatever gets them in the door.
Whatever works.
Yeah. So and were you a librarian when you were?
No.
No. Yeah.
No. Whispering is fine. I think people instinctively lower their voices and that kind of thing. No, I was never that. And you need to be the kind of person, I think, and our people, I believe, are, that listen to their patrons, whether they're a kid telling them about they don't want to go to Aunt Lulie's for Christmas, or that what kind of horrible teacher they have, or whatever. You have to be a listener. You have to be a people person, because if you aren't, you won't enjoy the job. And I retired when I was 70, but I was really didn't want, I retired mainly because we were going into the district library then, and everything was changing so dramatically. The financial part of it was changing, and everything was changing, so our rules and regulations, everything. And so that I felt that was a good time to leave. But as far as the job itself went, I probably would still, me and my cane.
You would still be here?
I'd still be here, you know, because I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the people, and if they had a project, you know, helping them with their project and things like that. It's a good job. I think more people, it's not a job you're probably ever going to get very, you know, wealthy.
You're going to get rich, right? Yeah.
You're not going to get rich, but you're going to get a lot of satisfaction out of it and good memories. And my kids could come here after school. So I'd know where they were, and so all in all, no, we had to go around to different town, all the townships that would had to sign on for a district.
Yep. So you were part of that when it started to switch then?
Right.
Okay.
And give a talk on why they should vote for it. And I can remember I went to one township meeting in Bay Township, and they were very antagonistic. The township board was, I probably shouldn't say this, but they were old, mostly old men who didn't read ever, and they just didn't see any point of a library. They didn't see what good it did. They didn't see any benefit from it whatsoever. So the night I knew was the important night, when they'd be voting very shortly about it, I asked to be able to speak, and then I salted the audience. I called Chris Scornia, a lot of other people that were from that township, and I said, I'm going to be there and I want backup. I want people there that are for the library, because you pay the taxes. So that's what matters to this board, is the money coming, their taxes, and they want to be reelected. And you've got to make them understand that maybe they won't be reelected if they don't vote the right way. And that's not probably the way things should be done. But I grew up with a grandmother who was in politics during the 1930s, during the Depression. And it was a very quid pro quo mentality. And so that's what happened, and they voted yes for it.
Yeah.
And but so if I really want something badly enough, I will use anything I have to.
Yeah, fish or fowl. Yeah.
I knew I liked you. I knew it.
You see, this is some of the sordid sides of being a head librarian.
Yeah.
And fortunately today you have accountants, you have people that support your library and do a lot of these tasks.
Right.
Well, when Janet had this, she would open her drawer and switch hats.
Yeah.
And right now she's got to be grandmother listening to a child that wants somebody to understand. And the next minute she's got to be the person saying, look, you've missed too much time, fish or cut bait.
Right.
And then, oh yes, you've got to be able to genuflect properly and kiss the right babies financially.
Yep.
So
right.
it's a multitask.
Yep.
Right, it is. There's a lot of politics.
There are.
In it.
There really are.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they don't teach you that in library school.
And I don't think because people would say to me, oh great, all you have to do is sit there and read books all day. They had no idea of the, because at one library meeting, at one time I was we had the librarians in this northern section of the state. We belonged to a group.
A co-op, probably.
Yes.
Yep.
And we'd have our meetings, and I was president of it. And I told them, I said, I wish that in the library curriculum, when people go to get a degree in library science, they don't get any business courses. And I think that that's a mistake. I feel that they should get business courses because it is a business.
Right.
And,
yeah, it is absolutely a business.
And so, you don't know how things, you know, go down. Not everybody likes to think that they're in a business.
Mm-hmm.
But you are,
yep.
whether you acknowledge it or not.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like right today. We've had a major shakeup in our government. We've had a major shakeup between the two parties, but you didn't see as many people in town, the merchants and people of dollar value, putting a Clinton or putting a Trump sign in their window.
Right.
You go out in the country where the good old boys live and you'd see signs all over the place. But inside, you have to be politically correct.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You have to realize that the person you're telling and you're talking to may all of a sudden not like you because you got a sticker out there that says one candidate or another.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's why we try really hard at the library to remain as neutral as possible, you know, provide
right.
both sides of the argument and let people decide for themselves. So.
And you have to make yourself available. If somebody gets in a bind, and they'll call you up and say, can you come and speak for 15 minutes or half an hour?
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of have to be in a position to say, sure, I'd love to. And then find out what subject they want you to, what their
yeah.
what
yeah.
their audience's interests are.
Yeah.
And I don't mind doing it. I was lucky I had debating in college. I was on my debating team, and I've always loved that.
Yeah.
So I don't mind getting up in front of people.
So city commissioners, they never stood a chance then.
The other city manager, I don't know Mr. Kane very well, but the other city managers, I went through, I think, 4 city managers, and they'd say, well, what do you think? Because they know I don't. And I almost always had an, I'm afraid I almost always have an opinion, too.
Yeah.
And I still do, so.
Well, to bring one of my other friends into this for just a minute, if you couldn't cover the bases, you'd send in Carl.
Right. And when I was home, I used to debate with him all the time. I mean, that was my husband. And we did not always see eye to eye on things. I mean, sometimes he was not what I would call to the left far enough. And because my grandmother and my mother walked in parades for women's right to vote.
Wow.
And so I've always been what I call on the fiscally conservative, but progressive in social matters.
Yep.
And my husband wasn't always that way, but I could always argue with him. He taught me a lot, like where are your facts?
Yep.
If you said a lot of people feel this way, he said, well, what do you mean by a lot of people?
Mm-hmm.
What is a lot, and where do you get this where's your information coming from? What do you have to back it up? And so I don't go into an argument or a talk without researching it first and in depth, because there's always somebody that will challenge you.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to be ready.
Yep.
And those are the things that a lot of the things that they don't teach
right
in your classes for librarianship.
Yep. Nope, they do not. I don't go after that.
And also, I look at the fact that you mentioned earlier you were 90 years old. I'm 78 years old.
Well,
today.
I'm 91, actually, okay. Ed, but
well,
you forget after a while.
I'll fudge by one for you. And when I look back the changes I've seen, and then I imagine the changes that you've seen and the changes you've seen in this town, it's just amazing what we've come through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it is, because I remember I was born during the real good times leading up to the stock market crash.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Depression came along.
Did you live here your whole life?
No.
No? Okay.
I lived in New Jersey. I was born and brought up in New Jersey, right out Elizabeth, New Jersey. It's right outside of New York City.
Got it.
20-minute train ride. And so I spent a lot of my time in New York City, too.
Wow.
I used to ride the subways when I was 12. Knew everyone.
Wow.
And it was, and then when I was to go to middle school, I had to walk through Little Italy.
Oh, wow.
And that was, I think it would be a revelation to a lot of people nowadays, because it isn't like people thought it was. I mean, they were very protective of their own in Little Italy. A young girl would never have to worry. She could always walk through there and be absolutely safe. And I've seen grown men, most of the Italian people had beautiful gardens. They were great flower growers. And I'd see little old ladies, all the little old ladies wore black. That is correct in the movies.
Yeah.
And I'd see a young man, or say in his 20s, and he'd be going up the front steps, and the guns were carried openly, and you knew that he was not the kind of person you'd really want to get into an argument with. And the little old lady, if he didn't wipe his feet right, she'd come out and hit him with a broom or something like that. I mean, it was a very matriarchal society.
Hmm.
And
that's cool.
And so I grew up in it was 100,000 people when I was growing up.
Wow.
And I remember the Depression. I was lucky. My father had a good job, and he was purchasing agent for the Alcoa for this one section of the East Coast. And it was, you saw so much. You saw the changing. I can remember we had a city pool, and white people went in the afternoon. At noontime, they changed the water.
Oh my gosh.
And white people, we went in the afternoon swimming. And then the water just stayed in from us. And then in the mornings, the black kids could go swimming. And it never occurred to me. I mean, it didn't even come through to me that this was anything unusual.
Wow.
It really didn't occur to me until my husband told me that one of his best friends was a young man who was black in the service, and when they would get off their ship and be down south, that they couldn't go in a lot of the restaurants and things like that, so my husband wouldn't go in either. Mm. And I think that's when it was brought home to me that there was that much discrimination, just because I didn't see it in our schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you moved to Boyan, did you find discrimination here?
There were no minorities here, Ed. There wasn't any. My kids grew up not knowing what minorities were.
Mine too. My kids
because,
grew up that same way.
No, they just didn't know, because there were none, really.
Was that hard, being a librarian? I mean, because it sounds to me like you're a pretty progressive person, you know. Did you find the ruralness challenging at times?
Well, I didn't. I guess, like I said, I really didn't notice it when I was smaller.
Mm-hmm.
I realized later that there was a lot I didn't notice when I was growing up, because I grew up in a household where my sister was in college when I was born, and so she was a doctor, an endocrinologist, and so lived and worked in New York.
She must have been like one of the first lady doctors, even.
Well, yeah. And she had some stuff published in the American Medical Association on cancer. And then she went out, and during the war, she worked, I don't know what, out in Colorado and in New Mexico, and with the atomic stuff, because
mm-hmm.
she had a degree in physics. And then she got cancer, and I think it was from stuff she worked with out there. Of course, nobody would ever admit to that or say that, but that was just my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
No, she might have noticed it. I don't know. You got to be a little bit cynical. And then, as I said, with my grandmother being in politics, mm-hmm. she can not controlled, but she had a little section, mostly the Italian section, and everything was in neighborhoods, which wasn't in Boyne City,
mm-hmm.
but in the big cities you had neighborhoods, and mine was a German English mm-hmm. neighborhood. And so you notice things that were going on then. Like I took German lessons in the 30s on Saturdays, until my mother decided to go with me to a couple of the lessons, and it was all Hitler's German.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
They wanted the kids to go to in groups and then go away to camps and things.
Oh.
And I can remember the discussions between my mother and father about how that wasn't for me.
Wow.
And everything. And I said, and if people would look at the, we had Fox News, like if you go to the movies, before and after the movie, I had Fox News.
Newsreel.
And
propaganda.
Newsreel. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's how you got a lot of your your visual news at any rate, because there was no television or anything, which my grandchildren don't believe. I think I'm lying about this,
yeah.
You know, along with me killing all the dinosaurs off. And it was really, I don't know about the Midwest, but in the East Coast, it was really kind of scary when you'd hear Hitler talking and seeing how the people in Germany were reacting to what he was saying and how virulent they were to anybody that didn't agree with them or anything. And then when the war came along, there was one section that of Germans that had come over in the 30s, young couples with children, and my mother thought there was something funny going on, because she said whenever there, I would be playing with my girlfriend and she would be called in the house for something. I was never allowed in any of the houses. And my mother it was a very social person.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were there when mealtime came along, you ate with us. And she thought there was something wrong with people that were so secretive. And they did, the FBI or whoever the group was at that time, then found there was a big, I don't know what were they called, group of them that were, they were in a Nazi group.
Oh,
and
wow.
They thought their primary purpose was to get people around them to try to think that the way they did. Mm-hmm. So when the war came along, we would rise up and join the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And they truly felt that this was doable, because they did not really understand the American psyche, I don't believe.
Mm-hmm.
And when my girlfriend's parents owned a delicatessen, and they found in the back of it was full of Nazi propaganda and guns and things to make bombs with, and the whole nine yards, they got sent to a concentration camp.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I grew up with a lot of changes.
Mm-hmm.
It was when you look back on it, it was much more interesting than anything my kids have ever seen socially and every which way, historically, yeah. And socially.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I almost feel sorry for them in a way, because a lot of times it wasn't always pleasant, but it was, you were learning something,
right,
all the time, and you were seeing history
in the making
and in progress.
Yeah.
And I realized how, like myself, I didn't even notice a lot of times what was going on around me. Or maybe it was just our neighborhood, you know, that could be too.
Well, generally as a group of people, we have a tendency to accept what we understand to be the norm.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, Dad's always worn a hat in the house. He takes it off when he sits at the table. So then he's got his hat on. Today, most people wear a hat in a restaurant. My dad would knock me down. So these are just some of the changes that were slowly equated in. The same way with our dress code. It used to be you wore some of the nicest clothes you had to church,
yep,
to weddings and to funerals, and that was it. Today, you wear anything you want, anywhere you want to go.
Right.
And it's, if somebody comes in with a three-piece suit on, all nicely decked out, it's, wow.
Yeah.
You know, where are you going? Or who are you? Well, when we're smaller, we accept this as the norm. When we get older, we accept, but we also question.
Right.
And I think that's one of the sad parts, that we have to be in our advanced age before we can understand what has happened. And we have a hard time communicating to people, even through a library and written books, of be careful because history is going to repeat itself.
Mm. Right, exactly. Oh, absolutely.
What are some of the biggest changes you've noticed in Boyne over your years being here?
Now, what was that?
The biggest changes in Boyne City.
Well, one of the biggest changes and saddest changes, it's not really, I suppose, it was to me, was when the drugstore, the old drugstore that used to be there, mm-hmm. had a soda fountain. Mm. And that was so nice because you could go in and have a regular soda and stuff like that. Mm. And I was always sorry when that came into being modernized. Mm-hmm. And wasn't a soda. And then there, the waterfront was full of factories when we moved here. And the water, if you went down, well, you know when you go down First Street and you come around the road that turns, makes a little U there. Mm-hmm. If you look at the water there, it was blue and green and red. I mean, oily looking. Mm-hmm. And that was from the tannery. And it didn't smell very nice either.
That's what everybody says. Yeah, they're like, if you could just smell the tannery.
I know, because when we were looking for property, we were going, there was a row of houses right behind the tannery, brick mm-hmm. houses. And they were at a very reasonable price. And they're very nice houses. But I couldn't stand the smell of, or the thoughts of living so close to the tannery wastes. Yeah. I don't know. If you go down far enough, if that's still in the sediment down at the bottom.
It's gone down a long ways. It really has. We have pictures here in the library of when one of the vessels was pulling out from being at the tannery dock. And this big plume of color coming out from behind the vessel. It would be the tan bark, the hair.
Right, and then we had the railroad, which was kind of nice.
Yep.
Because I can remember taking the first stove I had. My stove came up from downstate, from Detroit, and it came on the railroad. Mm-hmm. And it'd go to Boyne Falls, and then it'd be shipped over in the little train. Yeah. And we used to be able to go on rides on that. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can't do that. I miss the railroads, and they were kind of nice. And then there was a big what do they call the turnaround, where the
roundhouse?
Yeah, where the railroads. The engines come in, and I don't know if they shift
down here in the roundhouse.
Right. They shift their trains from one engine to another there? Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what
roundhouse and switchyard. Yes.
Right, and then there was the lumberyard. Handy's lumberyard mm-hmm. was Handy's, down there.
Yep. And there were five major lumber companies in Boyne. And some of them were gone by 1920.
Okay.
But Barden's was the one which has stayed the longest and is still there.
Right.
It's, you're a history buff. I remember going into Barden's and asking if I could borrow any pictures that they had. I'd like to copy them and return them to them. And one of the younger Barden's looked at me and said, Eddie, you forget we burned out twice. That tells you a lot about our history. They didn't have old photos left.
Yeah.
It's fire has done a great deal to this town.
Yep.
But it's
and then there was an ice house down where the trailer park is mm-hmm. now. It was an ice house. I can remember going there to get ice. And and
they'd chop ice out of the lake
for your fridge, or
for
just...
the well. When I first moved here, I had a ice box.
Wow!
Not a refrigerator. And then my husband, who was Swedish, wanted meringues, and I told him I couldn't bake unless I had an oven. And I didn't want any of the, I wanted a built-in oven, which was absolutely unheard of. But I had seen it somewhere in a magazine or read about it or something. And so we went down state and I got my built-in oven.
Wow.
And then Mr., I can't remember his name. He was an electrician. His son was Bob, and
Tim Klein, Miller Klein, from Boyne Falls.
Yes.
Yes.
And he was a master electrician, and he put my oven in, he said, "You're the first house around here to have circuit breakers instead of
fuses."
Instead of fuses.
The screw-in kind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So that was.
So what year did you move here?
We moved here, let's see. I should remember that because that's the year Matthew was born. And Matthew's my oldest son. And let's see, well, okay. Matthew is 61 or 62. So it was in the 50s, 55.
Yep. Wow, so you've been here a long time.
And it was very, the town was almost, it was still, a lot of it, I think, was still back in the Depression days. Don't you think so, Ed?
In the 50s, when you got here? What
yeah.
brought you here?
Well, we lived in Florida, and my husband didn't really care for Florida. I liked it, but he didn't really care for it. And we were looking for houses, and I was pregnant with Matthew, and I wanted to settle down somewhere. And he had come, his parents lived in Birmingham, and so he had come up to visit his parents, and they had driven up around this part of the state, and he told me that I would like it and everything. And I wanted so badly to have our own place and settle down, and we were you'll laugh at this, we were going to grow all our own food, we were going to live off the land.
So you guys are kind of like hippies in a way.
Yeah, we
yeah.
were.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, probably about as hippie as we were going to get. And we were going to live off the land and grow our own food and stuff like that, you know.
Wow.
Have chickens and all that kind of thing. And so I came up, well, no, I went to visit my sister because they thought she was going to die, and I went out to Colorado to visit her.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back and came to Michigan, and I came up and saw the old Dietz farm. And I said, yes, it was okay. And I really would have liked to have been on the water, but it wasn't salt water. And I was crazy about salt water.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up on salt water. And so we bought that.
And that's farm. Where you are now, right?
Yes,
East
that's
Road?
Where
okay.
we are now. So.
Wow.
And we did grow a lot of vegetables and things, but the growing season is not long enough to grow a variety that you'd want. And we tried chickens, and unless you heat the chickens in the wintertime, you have dead chickens.
Yep.
And what do you do with them? You can't, something you've called cutie, you can't eat.
Right.
I
yeah.
mean, and so... I can't, anyway.
I couldn't, yeah.
No, and...
Okay, I'm the savage.
And so that whole thing kind of went down the the dream. We became a little more realistic, I guess. And, oh well, it doesn't hurt a little bit.
Right.
We had a lot of great times. It, like I said, we never made an awful lot of money, but we still, and it was a great place to raise children.
Mm-hmm.
Kids could walk around and be safe.
Did you ever regret that they didn't have, because like you mentioned before, there wasn't a whole lot of diversity here. Were you ever sad about that?
No, that didn't bother me as far as the people went, because for us, just Boyne Falls being almost all Polish was diversity for us.
Mm-hmm.
And there was diversity in a different sense. And this sounds, it was a diversity in an educational sense. There was a group of people that I know our neighbors, really, they weren't friendly to us or anything, because we had come with a station wagon, an old woody station wagon, and in it we had a mattress and books. And anybody that would just consider their possessions books was thought to be, we might be communists under those books or something. And there was the diversity in that. There was definitely a sort of class feeling. If you had been to school beyond high school, or if you hadn't, and
so more like socioeconomic diversity.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I think that's true today, even.
Yes, I think so. I don't think quite as much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It like I told my kids, I grew up in a family where I was told I could do anything or be anybody or do anything I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I always believed that, and so I always said to my kids, no matter what anybody, because we weren't very wealthy, I made my own maternity clothes, and I said, but I'll never forget, I said, I'm better than anybody else, I'm smarter than most of the people I know, and I said, also, I said, I look down on people rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
And it has nothing to do with money, because the kids would meet people and they have a house here, or they have a boat, or they have this or they have that, and I didn't want them to feel that was what they should measure things by. And so I did, there was a little bit, I mean, I can remember Lisa, my oldest daughter, going to school, and the teacher, she came home in tears, and the teacher had told her that her vocabulary was too big, and that she was just being pretentious. And she told them that that's how everyone spoke at home.
Mm-hmm.
Because my husband, being foreign, being born in another country, he had to learn English the way we would learn a foreign language. And so we'd, at night, we during our dinner hour, we'd sit around the table, and if the kid said, well, that dinner was good, Mom, he'd say, well, what do you mean by good? Was it tasty? Was it nice to look at? What do you mean? And he'd make them use different words for a simplistic word.
Mm-hmm.
And we always kept dictionaries around, and things like that. So the kids did have, and I told Lisa, well, that was just a an ignorant thing for her to say.
Yeah.
And then I was one of those parents that when I'd come, this principal would see me coming, he'd find something to do, find a meeting he had to go to. Because if I thought anything wasn't kosher, why, I'd be down at school.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And because that's just, I think that's, it's like when City Hall and Nancy got in, something wasn't right about between them. Well, I went down to City Hall and took care of it. Because as far as I'm concerned, when you're the boss, that's your job to take care of the people that work for you.
Yep.
And that's what you're supposed to do. You look out for them, just like you do your kids. And you always want your kids to know that you're there. If they're wrong, you might wallop them one. But if they're right, then you're there and you'll stick up for them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's, and also I used to make hot chocolate, so when the street guys came around and did the sidewalk and everything, I'd give them hot chocolate.
Smart.
I always got my sidewalks taken care of.
Smart. That's really smart.
Cookies and hot chocolate. Be surprised what that can do.
Yeah, that's really smart.
So.
Yeah, it can be bribed.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Make it work better.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
That's being political.
Yes.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yep.
And so.
Yep, you are definitely right. So I have to ask you
yes,
this question.
Yes, I'm sorry. We have digressed, so.
No, this is just something that has just been, ever since I read this article, it has just, I'm like, I have to talk to her about this. So I was reading in the library scrapbook about a time when you wanted to do away with charging fines for people for overdue books. And that, I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And you, in the article, you're quoted as saying something about you were concerned that it would keep kids from checking out books, that they would be afraid of their parents and what their parents may or may not do to them if they had fines on their account. And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. It was just so neat.
Well, a lot of the, I think more so, not so much anymore, but parents used to, if a kid did have a fine or something, the corporal punishment was very, very much in vogue.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And it seemed like just from having patrons who came in and who've come in and talked to me about you and stuff, one of the things that I really appreciate that you've done is it seemed like you always had patrons' backs. Like, I know of people who would say that you would come in if they had a book report that was due the next day, they could call you at home and you would meet them down here and let them in, and just so many cool stories.
Well,
like that
was because I enjoyed what I was doing.
Right. Yep.
And I was lucky. A lot of people maybe wouldn't enjoy doing that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed it. And you meet nice people that aren't nice, don't go to libraries. People that are nice go to libraries. You always met nice people.
Yep.
Well, once in a while, I had a parent call me at 1 o'clock in the morning, and they said their child had brought a book home from the library, and the mother had opened it to a page where there was something that they didn't think was sexually appropriate written down there, and I read the thing. I couldn't see anything. The kid probably wasn't talking about to its friends.
Yeah.
And felt kind of sorry for the mother if she wasn't aware of what was happening in the world. But I tried, I had to explain to her that there was no censorship at the library.
Yep.
You know, it was up to the parents if they didn't want their children. I mean, they can't say to me don't let Susie or Johnny take out this kind of book. That's up to them to come with them then, mm-hmm. and say, don't read the books. Not to...
Did you have a lot of people who would challenge books here in the library?
Had a few. You know, you always find somebody who can find fault with a book and want to ban it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a banned book list.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we celebrate a banned books week every year.
Yes.
Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah.
Banned.
The Bible.
Huh? You know, I can ban the Bible for religious beliefs. Okay. But what's wrong with Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn?
Yeah.
Well, one of the characters was a black man.
Right.
And he's referred to by color. I mean, give it a break. Look at the time period this book was written.
Exactly.
Get real. But no, today, no. So some of the banned book principles are just way overboard. It's past reasonable.
Right, because what you ban today will be in vogue in a month,
mm-hmm.
or vice versa.
Right. Well, and just because you don't agree with it doesn't necessarily mean that it should be, you know, forbidden from anyone from looking at it.
Right.
Yeah. So.
How are we doing on our time?
We're good. We're at 1:26, so we can wrap it up whenever.
Yeah, now do you have any...
I could talk to you all day, though, about the library, because I just love it, and I'm so, you know, appreciative for everything that it is, everything that it stands for, everything that the people who came before have worked to make it be what they made it to be.
It's very definitely a community effort.
Yep.
Well, on a scale of 1 to 10... The written book is dying. Publishers are going out of business. Bookstores are going out of business. And I've watched this because my wife and I read.
Right.
Pat wants to hold the book in her hand.
I do too.
Me too.
And I don't fall very far from that point myself. Well, I've noticed Boyd's Library has stayed with the books. They've stayed with books that the area seems to be reading. Also, they have gone to the modern means of communication, computers, CDs, videos, VCRs. What is your feeling on all of this?
Well, I can't take a television to bed with me. I can take a book to bed, and mm-hmm. I do.
Yeah.
Religiously, and I want the printed, and if people would, like, people will watch a television show or see a movie, and if they, it will be so different than the book that you wouldn't even know it was the same. There's a movie called Sahara.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the book first, and the book was wonderful. The movie is, you wouldn't know that they were the same two stories.
Wow!
If you knew you weren't supposed to, I mean, they weren't supposed to be. They're supposed to be the same stories, and so. I don't know, nothing will take the place of the written word as far as I'm concerned.
And I think that there was just a study that was put out that says that the e-books have plateaued, that people, they've just, because they were rising, you know, they were never as popular as print books, but they've started to just kind of level off. So I think people have that. You know, because I'm the same way. I want to read a book. I don't want to read it. I can't read it on a phone or, you know.
I don't either. Mm-hmm. No. No, I know my son-in-law read Well, he was reading a book on his cell phone, mm-hmm. and I was thinking, that's going to ruin your eyes.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah, and there's something about the feel of it, the smell of it,
right.
You just can't get that from a tablet. So
no, I've got too many books at home, and but then I probably always will, and. Luckily, my husband was the same way as I was,
mm-hmm.
and my kids like to read. I don't know about my grandkids. I don't think they're so into the machinery things mm-hmm. that I don't think they're particularly big readers, which is kind of a shame, but I don't really... That may turn around sometime.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So what's something that you hope the library always does for the community?
I hope that they always have books and try to, like I said, find out what people want to read, not what we should read, or not what's good for us to read. Not have anybody tell us what is, let it still be a place of freedom.
Because
mm-hmm. mm-hmm. yep. that was the whole idea of it at the beginning, I think. Not just to have books, but to have freedom of ideas. You may not like a lot of the stuff you read. I mean, I picked up a couple of books in the nonfiction center that I don't like the people who wrote them,
mm-hmm.
but I wanted to see what they were about, and I didn't like a lot of the things that were said in the books, but that's their right to express themselves,
right.
And I don't have to pick up the book and read it. I can put it down, and so it's kind of... It's a bastion of freedom, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at the major libraries that have been destroyed in history, there are two powers that have destroyed these libraries. One is in the name of religion, the other one is in the name of politics.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the world's major libraries have gone to ashes for those two reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's and usually when somebody takes over, it's the educated people that they want to get rid of first.
Yep.
And from the library comes education. And that's, I like the fact that this Boyne Library, I consider it a self-perpetuating education. If I walk in here a dozen times, maybe once or twice somebody will recommend a book to me. But usually I'm looking at names, I'm looking at authors, or I'm looking at the dust cover. Now I'm visually impacted to something, and then I'll read an excerpt from it and no thank you. Or yet, Berlin, 1920, 1930, 1940. I'll take it home and read it because that time period has affected me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Boyan, and probably from some of your previous leadership, has maintained a steady flow of a variety of books.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I like about the library is the fact that if I ask for help on something, it's usually very
right.
fast and rapid coming. Or if I ask for a book, I've never had to ask twice for the same book. I mean, sometimes they said it's coming from New York or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, bring it in.
Right.
But it's the library is serving the public.
And I like because it's anybody can come in and
yes.
read a book.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Everybody, no matter your whatever, you everyone is treated the same here.
Right.
Yep.
I mean, we used to have a when I first started, there used to be a leather wing chair. It isn't here anymore. And there used to be a guy called Dirty Ed. Do you remember Dirty Ed? And he would drink himself into oblivion. Mm-hmm. But he'd always make it to the library, and he'd pass out in the chair, basically, and then he'd urinate.
Oh,
and so we had to finally get rid of the chair. But I mean, he didn't really hurt anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a sort of, I think for him, a sort of place of refuge as much as anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like his smell, but that's all right. I'm fussy.
Yeah. Now, we have patrons now who, you know, you wonder if they have a home to go to and stuff like that, but they're everybody. You know, if you need our help, we're here to help you.
Right.
Whatever we can do. Yep. Yeah, you're almost like a social worker some days.
Right,
too.
Yes. No,
yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
But that's all right.
Yep. Yeah, it's definitely a job for people who love people.
Right.
Yep.
Right. And you have to be sometimes able to change your own opinions on things.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Definitely. My working here, I've only been here for 6 years, but I've, you know, it's really taught me a lot about myself and a lot about my community and a lot about people. And I've had to change the way I think about a lot of different things, which I appreciate. I think it's made, you know, my life better.
Oh, yes.
Yep. So, all right, well, should we maybe wrap it up, and I'll stop this.